speaker who has no connection with blindness, as far as I know, neither with deafness.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to let him tell you what he's going to talk about. I heard that it's a very windy story. So introducing John
Horrigan.
Mr. John Horrigan, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mary. Well, it's a pleasure to be here at the Brookline Senior Center speaking for the Brookline Low Vision Group. Wonderful May day. My name's John Horrigan. I'm a folklorist. That means that there's no prefix before my name and no suffix following my name or any mortgage-sized student loan nipping at my heels. As my wife would say, jack of all trades, master of none. So I'm a bit scattered, but I love studying historical weather. And today, we're going to be talking about, I'm going to be reading to you about the New England Lighthouse Storm, a tremendous gale that struck New England in April of 1851. I was just a young man at that time. And it toppled Minot's Lighthouse, which is a very famous lighthouse off the South Shore. And I'm going to be reading from one of my favorite books by Edward Rowe Snow, Storms and Shipwrecks of New England, and also from Historic Storms of New England by Sidney Perley. Basically 1851. Let's go back there. The flip of a coin determines whether a new city in the Oregon Territory is named after Boston, Massachusetts, or Portland, Maine. Who do you think won? Portland, Oregon. March 27, 1851. The first reported case of Anglo-Saxons seen in the Yosemite Valley. On June 21st, an immortal game of chess between Adolf Anderson and Lion Kurzeritsky, which was known around the world, is completed. And then the yacht America's Cup, America wins the first America's Cup race on August 27th, 1851. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Does anybody know who the president was of the United States in 1851? He was the last member of the Whig Party to be elected president, 13th president. Millard Fillmore, the immortal Millard Fillmore. You could probably name 35 before him. This story develops off the coast of Cohasset and Scituate. Two dangerous areas for ships known as the Grampuses and Minot's Ledge. These had known to snare ships for ages. They were a treacherous ledge and jagged rocks. Most of the reefs lay just below the waterline and were only exposed during low tide. And there's a tricky rip current that pervades in the area off the coast of Cohasset and Scituate. So it seemed that every time that there was a northeaster, ships were driven into this ledge. So it was decided that a lighthouse was needed to warn off the ships. And the Minot's Ledge, where they built the lighthouse, was only 20 feet across at a normal low tide. Now, there are a lot of shipwrecks from 1817 to 1847 prior to the construction of Minot's Ledge Lighthouse. I'll call it Minot's Light, okay? Basically, the St. John, which was a Irish immigrant ship, wrecked there on October 7th, 1849, 100 people losing their lives. Captain Daniel Lothrop found that at least 39 ships were wrecked off the coast of Cohasset in just that 30-year period. And Native Americans of Scituate and Cohasset were convinced that their god of gales called Hobomok, and there's an area in southeastern Massachusetts called Hockomock, was responsible for driving the vessels of the white man onto the Grampuses. So Native Americans thought that they were being protected. They placed trinkets, beads, and arrowheads out onto the Conehasset Rocks, that's what it was called, as an offering for the Great Spirit. And Samuel de Champlain, the great explorer, sailed fairly near Minot's Ledge on July 17, 1605. John Smith, the great explorer of Jamestown, mentions of the Indian tribe of the Quanahasset, which became Conehasset and then Cohasset, when he sailed down the coast in 1614. Captain Smith got in a quarrel with the Quanahasset Indians and was ambushed as he left the harbor. Many arrows were slung at his longboat as he and his men made their way back to the ship near Hominy Point. Smith fired his gun and killed one Indian while wounding another. Many believe that Smith Rocks are named after him and this incident. So 40 lives and $364,000 worth of 19th century property were lost between 1817 and 1847. So an inspector by the name of I.W.P. Lewis of the Lighthouse Service of America emphasized that they needed a lighthouse on Monnet's Ledge. Captain William Smith, and he's the culprit in our story because he's the architect of this lighthouse, recommends an iron pile lighthouse as offering less resistance to the waves than the stone tower. So imagine a water tower that you've seen on pylons, and imagine that being out in the ocean and calling it a lighthouse, right? So if you can just think of how flimsy the structure is. The ledge, as I mentioned, was only 20 feet wide and was exposed at low tide, being dry only 2 or 3 hours a day. So on this narrow rock construction was begun in the spring of 1847, a 75-foot openwork iron light structure. The men could only work on very calm days when the tide was at its ebb. The work was conducted from a schooner, which remained near the ledge at sea unless the sea was too rough, and the workmen would sleep on board the ship. If a storm threatened, the schooner would put into Scituate Harbor until it was over. So what they did is they drilled 9 holes, 5 feet deep, 9 inches in diameter, and they drilled it in a circle in the rock on Monnet's Ledge. The idea for Swift, and I don't think the man was too swift when everything's said and done at the end of this talk, that water would run through the pilings. Now, as you know, the ocean refuses no one, and a driving ocean with the tons per cubic feet can knock down any pilings. There were 9 wrought iron pillars. They were 40 feet in height, placed in the holes. The iron stilts were 60 feet above the water, and the entire tower structure was about 75 feet tall. The lighthouse weighed about 30 tons. The first floor was the deck where the keeper's boat was kept, and the keeper's boat is the only communication to land. Remember, in this time period in 1851, there's relatively little telegraph service, and especially not from a lighthouse. So their only communication was to get into the boat and row to land. The second floor of the lighthouse was a storeroom, the third floor was the living room, and the top floor a lamp room. So it was a grim sentinel of the sea with a forehead of flame, according to Sidney Perling, and it was 10 feet in diameter with an extreme height of 87 feet. The lamp was state-of-the-art. It had 20 burners and silver-plated concave reflectors that were 2 feet in diameter. A cable stretched to a buoy that was moored outside of the breakers. And on that line was a wooden box, which was the only means of communication between the house and the boat. So when the boat put down, the boat was several stories below, and put out to sea, there was a line where they could run a box of materials out to the boat to send it to shore. Before we go on, I just want to talk about the famous highest tide in the history of Boston before the lighthouse storm. It was the famous high tide of 1723. Cotton Mather, quote, "tide and storm of uncommon circumstances. It inundated the city of Boston while people were at church. It was the first major northeaster, and it arrived on February 23rd and 24th of 1723. And it arrived at the time of the spring tide and drove water 20 inches higher than had ever been observed, and it swept away wharves, inundated streets, and flooded cellars and stores." It was an incredible storm, and in fact, young Benjamin Franklin wrote a humorous piece about the storm and describing people's behavior. So with that, I'd like to cut over to our book today, and it's just a few pages here. Minot's Light Storm, Edward Rowe Snow from Storms and Shipwrecks of New England. The storm, which began on Monday, April 14th, 1851, developed into a gale which proved to be one of the severest of the century along the shores of Massachusetts. Damage to shipping was estimated in hundreds of thousands of dollars, while property all along the coast was destroyed. Many of the residents of New England remembered the gale for one reason: the total destruction of Minot's Ledge Lighthouse off the shores of Cohasset, Massachusetts. The light had been built because of the many shipwrecks in the area south of Boston. In 1847, Captain Daniel Lothrop made a survey of the shipping losses in the vicinity from 1817 to 1847. He found that 39 ships had been wrecked off Cohasset during that time period, with the loss of many lives, so a lighthouse was needed and a lighthouse was built. Completed on January 1st, 1850, the tower was constructed on iron stilts, which rose to a height of 60 feet above the water. The entire height of the tower was 75 feet. In the spring of 1850, several great storms weakened the lighthouse, causing the keeper to resign his position, but a new man was found willing to accept the responsibility and danger. So I just want to stop here and editorialize. This thing was already on its way out. And the first guy who resigned, the first keeper, said, it's not safe enough. So he resigns, and it's already in trouble. And then the years 1850 and 1851 and 1852 in Boston were unprecedented bad weather years. You had a tornado that went through the streets of Medford in 1851. You had this lighthouse storm in 1851 in April. And then later that October, something called the Yankee Gale. And I don't think we're going to have a chance to talk about that. But that's decimated the fishing fleet in New England all the way up to Newfoundland. So it's a bad year for weather. So with the coming of 1851, John W. Bennett, the new keeper, realized that the tower was in danger. He wrote several letters asking to have the lighthouse strengthened. But since the man who built the tower, Captain William H. Swift, scorned any suggestion that the light would fall, nothing was done. So there's a man's ego putting lives in jeopardy. A terrific tempest swept the Atlantic in March, and the tower swayed 4 feet in the gale. Damage was great, but the storm finally went down. The assistant keeper, Joseph Wilson, visited Boston on a leave a few days later. During his stay in the city, a friend asked him whether it would be difficult to hire another capable man for the position in the event that keeper John W. Bennett gave up his post at the lighthouse. "Yes, sir," he replied. "I shall stay as long as Mr. Bennett does, and when we leave the light, it will be dangerous for any others to take it." End quote. The young man was only 20 years old, but he was feeling rather happy that the winter was over. He was looking forward to being at the light the coming summer, with the warmth and sunshine making up for the winter of terror he had recently experienced. But the summer never came for Assistant Keeper Wilson. While he was in Boston, he was also asked what he would do if the light should fall. He answered that he was quite confident of reaching the shore. In view of what actually happened 3 weeks later, his remarks take on special significance. His final statement was that he would stay at the light as long as the tower stood. When the time came, that is exactly what happened. The head keeper, John W. Bennett, spent the next days at the light tightening and strengthening the braces. He found the dory smashed beyond all hope of repair, however, and made arrangements to go to Boston to purchase a new one as soon as Assistant Keeper Wilson returned from his leave. A relatively calm spell was enjoyed the first week in April 1851, but around the 8th of that month, easterly winds began to blow. Bennett decided to leave the light when the east wind diminished somewhat, and on the morning of Friday, April 11th, he flew the signal for the boat to come out. In other words, he's putting the flag up on the lighthouse saying it's safe to come out with your boat. Leaving the week instruction in charge of the two assistant keepers, Joseph Antoine is one of the assistant keepers, and Joseph Wilson, head keeper Bennett sailed away from the lighthouse never to return. It was the last time he saw either man alive. So Bennett's going to get a new boat because their dory smashed up. He leaves the two assistants in charge, and wait till you hear what happens. Arriving on the mainland, Keeper Bennett proceeded to the Custom House in Boston, where he interviewed collector Philip Greeley concerning the purchase of his new dory, his new boat. The next day he returned to Cohasset and made an effort to reach the light, but the easterly wind had increased so that a heavy sea was running at Minot's Ledge. Sunday, the wind grew stronger, and by night the surf was seen hitting fairly high against the structure of the lonely ledge. Late Monday, the wind had developed into a full gale, which intensified to hurricane force by Wednesday morning. So what I just told you about is a four-day storm. This is a one-eyed monster, whatever this thing is. It starts hitting us on Sunday, and here it is. It hasn't even reached its full potential until Wednesday. We're all New Englanders, and we know about that. The exact course of the storm on April 16th, 1851, was east-northeast. Okay, so it's moving from the east. It's a nor'easter, and it's a big one. On the mainland, the storm was causing considerable destruction up and down the coast. Scituate Harbor was damaged to the extent of $5,000. That's $1,851. Several houses on Pleasant Beach in Cohasset were entirely swept away. A large three-story hotel was floated right out from its underpinning, with almost a score of guests escaping in time. Imagine that, you're at a hotel and all of a sudden you're on a cruise. A few moments after the occupants had left the building, the sea broke over it, smashing the hotel into four great sections in a comparatively short time. The storm raged all along the coast, from New York to Portland, Maine. The feeling was general that the storm brought a higher tide and greater gale than any since December 1723 and December 1786, when 13 people froze to death at Lovell's Island in Boston Harbor after their ship had been wrecked. The tide at Dorchester, Massachusetts, rose 7 feet higher than usual, while a Brighton man crossing the Cambridge Bridge was blown into the Charles River, but saved himself from drowning. The old railroad depot at Wilmington Junction and two barns at Tewksbury were demolished, with a house and many chimneys blown down at Danvers. Church steeples suffered in many localities. That of the New Baptist Church in Charlestown was blown down, the steeple crashing on a Mr. Locke of Lexington, who died shortly afterwards. The steeple of the Catholic Church in Pawtucket, one of New England's tallest, was blown down. East Boston's new Episcopal Church at the corner of Decatur and Paris Streets was moved from its foundations on Tuesday night and blown down entirely the following day. Deer Island in Boston Harbor was in the direct path of the tempest. The new seawall was destroyed, and the water swept right across the island to carry three buildings out to sea. The boys at the Deer Island School had a narrow escape, as they were caught in their dormitory with the water steadily rising around them. The instructor waded through water 3 feet deep to warn them out of danger. By midnight, the water had risen to a height of 5 feet, and the roof of the building fell in. The instructor and the boys feared that they would be drowned as the waves battered the house, but by dawn, a team of oxen arrived and took them to higher ground. A few hours later, the boys watched their dormitory swept out to sea. The passage through what's known as Shirley Gut was widened to twice its former size. Winthrop, Massachusetts, which is across from Shirley Gut from Deer Island, was heavily hit by the gale. In the Point Shirley district, Taft's Hotel was inundated, and the waves breaking completely over the structure to destroy the front of the hotel. The occupants fled to higher ground, stopping with Mr. Wyman for the night. At the height of the storm, the roof of the Taft barn was carried away, crashing on a pleasure yacht on the back beach, completely demolishing the craft. At Pleasant Beach, Isaiah Baker had a public house. Mr. Baker was able to escape with his boarders before the building broke up completely. Several vessels were pushed ashore onto the beach, with a number of sailors drowned. The Fay family, then living at Winthrop Beach, were rescued just in time as their house was hit by the surf. So you've got three hotels full of people that a huge wave demolishes them while people are inside. Derby Wharf in Salem was ruined. The railroad track at Collins Cove and the bridge between Forrester Street and Northeast Point were carried away, and the sea rushed into the tunnel. In Beverly, the sea washed over Tuck's Point and over Water Street, while the tide in Gloucester was said to have been the highest in 50 years. Michael Dooley's store then was carried away. The Merrimack River rose 22 inches higher than the record of December 1839, flooding warehouses and cellars on the lower side of Water Street in Newburyport. $20,000 damage was sustained in that town. Below South Street, the river swept over the whole length of the Turnpike Road to Plum Island. And I'm just going to pause here and cut over to the brig, the Primrose. Listen to this shipwreck here. Cutting over to Sidney Perley's Historic Storms of New England. Page 259. During the storm, Plum Island presented a desolate appearance. On Wednesday morning, the turnpike from Newburyport to the beach was covered with water and impassable. The sea at one time broke completely over the island, in some parts leaving lakes and ponds when the storm subsided. The brig Primrose, Captain Boakman, master, bound from Pictou, Nova Scotia to Boston, was laden with coal and foundering badly off of Salisbury Beach on Tuesday the 15th. The captain had not been able to take an observation for several days, and supposed that they were in Boston Bay until Tuesday night, when he discovered that they were nearing the reefs of the northern end of Plum Island. The vessel was lying to just outside the breakers on the next morning, and it was evident that she could not long withstand the sea, which was forcing her onto the beach. The wind swept through the rigging terrifically, and the mainsail was soon torn away. The crew's control over the brig was gone. Being driven into the breakers, she struck a reef about 200 yards from the shore and about a half mile below the first relief house toward the Emerson Rocks. Two young fellows named T.G. Dodge and a Mr. O. Rundlett, two young men belonging in Newburyport, happened to be on the beach during the storm, and at about 10:30 in the forenoon they discovered the wreck. The crew could plainly see them on the beach and communicated with them by signals as the brig gradually beat onto the sands. So readers note, as the howling wind, they couldn't hear them yelling, but they were signaling with hand gestures. And I'm sure we can imagine what those hand gestures were, like, help me. The mariners then endeavored to throw a line on shore, but it failed to come near enough to be secured until after the young man had stood in the surf for 3 hours. So they're standing in the surf, trying to save the ship, pounding surf, for 3 hours. In the meantime, they had been joined by two other men, a Mr. Lufkin, who lived on the island, about 2 miles below the wreck, and his hired man, who had learned of the disaster and had come to render assistance. This was little before 1 o'clock in the afternoon. After another hour's toil, about 2 o'clock, the rope was secured by the four men, and the captain and crew, with a single passenger, 9 people in all, were thus rescued from their perilous situation. Great credit is due to the men who persevered so long in their exposure to wet and cold and their exhausting endeavors to save the shipwrecked mariners. The brig would lay embedded in the sand until the ensuing July, 1852, when she would be towed off, her cargo having been taken off by the steamer C.B. Stevens, which then plied on the Merrimack River between Newburyport and Haverhill. So that's just the Primrose. Let's get back to our story here. We're getting to the good part of the lighthouse. Only a few more minutes here, folks. The brig Primrose, as I mentioned, went ashore off Plum Island. In Newcastle, New Hampshire, the ocean washed across the roads, making an island of Jaffrey Point. Several families, believing that another deluge had come to destroy the world, did nothing to escape as they felt that they were doomed. So these are people that thought that the end was nigh, and why do anything? Because we're all going to perish. The next day, however, the tide went down and they returned to their regular pursuits. Many schooners were driven ashore at Rockport, Nahant, and Salem Harbor. 7 vessels were wrecked at Marblehead, while it is known that a number of mariners were drowned off of Marshfield. The city of Boston actually became an island during the Wednesday high tide, as the waters swept across the neck, cutting off the city from the mainland completely. Now, this is before Back Bay was filled in, but if you think of a lollipop on a stick, that's what Boston basically looked like, the Shawmut Peninsula, with this narrow causeway connecting the city of Boston. And that was breached, so it was an island for a time. And the tide flowed entirely across Washington Street, near the corner of Waltham Street. In downtown Boston, the waves swept right up State Street, and the area around the Custom House was 3 feet underwater. This is a big flood. Broad Street was partially submerged, the waves continuing up Central and Milk Streets. It's said that Merchant's Row was reached by the great tide. The record high tide submerged both the Charlestown and Chelsea bridges. The Evening Transcript of April 16, 1851, reported that no cars operated over the Old Colony Railroad line that morning. The rails have been washed up, this is what the newspaper says, so that they lie crosswise hundreds of feet in many places. This is believed to be the highest tide ever known in Boston. It began to recede slowly about 12 o'clock. Thousands of spectators flocked down to the wharves to witness the grand spectacle which the waters presented. Great apprehensions are felt in regard to the lighthouse at Minot's Ledge. The weather is still too misty to distinguish if it is still standing. So at the time this article was written, however, Minot's Light was still fairly upright. So here you have the paper, folks, predicting that this thing's going to fall over. Everybody knew it was going to fall over. It's not that it was an unknown tragedy. It was just a poorly constructed lighthouse. Well, the two heroic keepers, the assistants, Joseph Antoine and Joseph Wilson, had continued to carry out their tasks in spite of the terrific odds against them. They kept the bell ringing and the lamps burning for the ships in distress outside the ledge. Their worst night, then, was about to begin. The storm seemed to have spent its fury, but as is so often the case, the great seas grew even higher as the evening came. No one will ever know the exact circumstances of the tragedy which befell the two brave keepers out on the rock. The following explanation is offered as a possibility. It is, however, an account in which all the known facts are put together in a sequence that may be considered reasonable. So here's Snow's account, okay? He's putting back together what happened. We know that several families living at the Glades area in Scituate saw the gleam of Minot's Light about 10 o'clock that fateful Wednesday night. Thus, we may naturally assume that the light was still standing at the time. The two men, realizing their danger would be greatest around high tide at midnight, prepared a message for the outside world in case they failed to survive the storm. Casting the bottle containing the message out from the lighthouse, Wilson and Antoine now made their plans for what proved to be their last night in this world. Can you imagine throwing a message in the bottle? Desperation. The wind had abated appreciably, but the great tide was slowly rising, sending wave after wave through the upper framework of the tottering structure. There was still just that terrifying surge of hundreds of tons of foaming surf just below them. The Doom's tower rocked perceptibly back and forth, and seemed about to crash at any time. Higher and higher the billows swept, until almost every wave smashed against the keeper's quarters 60 feet above the ledge. These are monster breakers. Probably around 11 o'clock that night, the central support snapped completely off, leaving the top-heavy 30-ton lantern tower to be upheld by the already weakened outside piling. The large 5 1/2-inch rope hawser, which had been fastened into position by Keeper Bennett, that's the thing I told you about the line to the buoy, ran from the top of the tower to a 7-ton granite rock located about 200 feet in the lee of the lighthouse. So this line runs from the top to 200 feet away. Keeper Bennett used this cable to get on and off the tower whenever a turbulent sea was running. So he would actually climb that, and they'd slide down that rope. Many believe that this cable, pulled by the huge rock as the boulder in turn was pushed toward shore by the sea, was a contributing factor in the destruction of the edifice. So the churning water pushed the cement anchor that held the tower, the line to the top of the tower, was moving that, so it's actually being pulled down inadvertently. Keeper Bennett usually slackened the hawser when a storm came up. So Keeper Bennett knew that this thing moved around on the ocean floor. But it's a question whether this was beneficial to the lighthouse. If the rock started moving, the slack would soon be taken up. With the central support cracked off, the tower became more and more dangerous. The cable attached to the rock probably had the same effect that a rock would have tied to the top of a high tree after it is almost chopped through, with the granite block creating a pull like men trying to bring the tree down. So they say it's a timber is just a stone's throw away. Inch by inch, the granite block moved towards the shore, gradually increasing the strain on the 8 remaining iron supports. Without question, the lighthouse slanted at an angle of 20 degrees from the perpendicular by midnight. The previous afternoon, a man with a telescope standing on the beach at Cohasset was peering anxiously in the direction of the ledge. He detected a decided list towards the shore when he occasionally saw the structure through the mist, and he felt that the lighthouse was doomed. So you have a man on shore seeing the thing leaning the day before and talking to himself saying it's going to fall. Well, just before 1 a.m. on the morning of April 17th, 1851, because of the combined forces of wind, sea, and straining hawser, the Minot's Ledge Lighthouse toppled over into the sea. One by one, the pilings broke, snapping like pipe stems, until only two or three remained. There, the tower rested for a time. The keepers realized that the end was near. Wishing in some way to communicate with their loved ones ashore, they seized the heavy hammer and began to pound furiously on the lighthouse bell. We know that this signal was heard, for many residents at the Glades in Scituate later recalled the sound of the bell, which came over the water to them, even above the roar of the surf, at about 1 a.m. that wild morning. With the tower so bent over that the storeroom and capping received the full force of each breaking wave, the remaining supports soon gave way, and the great tower plunged beneath the ocean waves. The government had made a costly mistake. The sea reclaimed the ledge for its own. But what about those two keepers, Wilson and Antoine? Well, letting themselves down by the hawser into the water, the two men, each with a life preserver strapped to his back, dropped into the boiling surf. We believe that Antoine and Wilson did come down the hawser, that's the line, for the stay was later found, and from its appearance it seemed probable that the lanyard connecting it to the lighthouse had been let loose. It had been tied in such a way that only human hands could have loosened it. The body of Joseph Antoine was washed ashore soon afterwards at Nantasket. The writer believes, this is Edward Rowe Snow, that it's possible that the young 20-year-old Wilson tried to live up to his expressed determination to reach land. This is the guy who said he was going to swim to land. A short distance from the Glades lies Gull Rock. Here it was that Joseph Wilson was washed ashore, more dead than alive, terribly chilled and bruised by the battering of the icy waves, almost like Prometheus bound. He crawled up to the top of the rock and discovered that he was not on the mainland. This disappointment, after his long swim from the lighthouse, was too much for Wilson, and he sank, exhausted, in a cleft of the Gull Rock, far above the reach of the outgoing tide. He probably died before morning of exhaustion and exposure, but it is not all conjecture, however, for when the body of Joseph Wilson was eventually discovered, the position and condition indicated that the young man had reached the rock alive. So there's some evidence that says Wilson did get to the rock. Just a couple more pages here, folks, and we're done. When Keeper Bennett had been prevented from going out to the tower, he went to his home on Whitehead near the Glades in Cohasset. Can you imagine the keeper? He couldn't get out to his lighthouse to save his men, so he had to retreat to his home. You think he could see the lighthouse from his front window. As the storm increased, the water swept across the shore and surrounded his residence, forcing the lightkeeper, Bennett, to leave his home. Restless and uneasy about the fate of his fellow workers out on the lighthouse, he wandered along the beach for the whole night. Around 4 a.m. the next morning, when dawn broke and light became more visible, perhaps at the very time when his assistant Wilson was near death on Gull Rock, John Bennett began to notice debris coming ashore. He went down to the edge of the sea. To his amazement, Bennett recognized some of his own clothing, which he had left at the lighthouse. Wreckage was also coming in, and he gathered two or three fragments from the rolling breakers. His worst fears were realized when he saw pieces of timber that were actually from the light itself, proving that without question, it had toppled. Captain William H. Swift visited the ruins of Minot's Ledge on April 22, 1851, and made a sketch of the ledge with the broken piling. He also drew the lighthouse tower itself, as it lay in the water with only a part of the side showing. He probably experienced the bitterest moments of his life when he stood out on the rolling deck of the boat and sketched the symbol of his costly failure. The gale, which caused the destruction of the lighthouse off of Cohasset, Massachusetts, has since been referred to as Minot's Light Storm of 1851 or the New England Lighthouse Storm. Minot's Ledge Lighthouse was rebuilt. A fine stone beacon rising to a height of 114 feet was erected on the side of the old tower, and after a wait of 9.5 years, the welcome gleam of its rays flashed out again on November 15, 1860. The tower was first lighted by Keeper Joshua Wilder, and although many fear that this tower may someday fall into the sea once again, the keepers feel that nothing else than an earthquake can ever shake it from its foundations. During the many yearly storms at the new lighthouse, the surf often goes over the very top of the tower, and one may very well imagine the lonely lives of the keepers pass on the ledge. As the gales roar in from the depths of the Atlantic Ocean with gigantic waves sweeping up the sides of the tower, the men in the lighthouse often think of that night in 1851, now so long ago, when two brave men stood side by side to keep their last faithful watch that ended up in eternity. And just to conclude, a couple of paragraphs here. The year 1851 was monumentally bad for New England shipping interests. Less than 6 months after the Minot's Light storm, the Yankee Gale of 1851 lambasted the Gulf of St. Lawrence and much of the New England fishing fleet. More than 19 vessels from Gloucester alone were lost in the storm, and it is estimated that a total of 160 lives were lost in the region. The Yankee Gale is considered the worst maritime marine disaster in the history of Prince Edward Island. The second Minot's Ledge Lighthouse, 1860, was renovated in the late 1980s. A short time later, the Cohasset Historical Commission oversaw the installation of a replica of the top portion of the lighthouse at Government Island, and from since that point, it's been automated. Now, that's the end of the story, but the lighthouse today gives the I Love You flash. And the I Love You flash is basically, it flashes in the night, one flash, then four, and then three. Which,
what does that mean?
It just says I Love You, those flashes. So one flash, four flashes, then three flashes, and it's been detected that is I Love You, one, four, three. So that's my talk for today. I don't want to get into the Yankee Gale, but it was a terrible, terrible tragedy. I don't think we have time, that struck the entire fishing seaboard. A number of New England vessels were lost during that gale. The Yankee Gale was October of 1851. So that entire year was a very, very poor year for storms. I mean, 85 American women and 350 American children were made orphans because of that storm. And it decimated the fishing fleet.
Storm as bad as that since then?
Well,
that was very interesting. Yep. Been a storm
since then. Yes, well, if we move forward in time, there was something in 1869 that I've discovered, something called Saxby's Gale, which also destroyed a number of ships. It's a nor'easter that came up the coast of New England, hooked off of Canada, and actually went across the sea to England and caused havoc there. There's the, if you look at the great hurricanes in the history of New England, there's basically three. 1635, which was the Great Colonial Hurricane. Governor Winthrop describes it as Indians having to climb up to the top of trees. The Great September Gale of 1815, where in Providence, during the hurricane of 38, they have marks where the river came up. Well, the gale passed it by 6 feet, and a water spout was actually seen on the Charles River. And then, of course, nobody's here. It was around in 1938, which is unfortunately, but the Great Hurricane of 1938, which I also lecture on, and I'd like to come back maybe sometime and talk to you about that in detail and get your recollections, because I think you'd really enjoy that presentation. But that, some of you people have experienced the hurricane as children of 38, and there's two generations that have no idea what a hurricane is like in New England. And the hurricane of 38 was a lateral buzzsaw out of a possible Category 5 being the worst hurricane. This hit a Category 3. The entire coastline was unprepared because in Washington, a young whippersnapper who was just filling in for one of the vacationing meteorologists said, "I think this hurricane out in the Caribbean is going to race up the coast and strike New England." And of course, the senior meteorologist at the National Weather Bureau in 1939 says, "I've been working this for 25 years, Sonny. A hurricane will never hit New England in my lifetime." Less than 24 hours later, the hurricane struck New England. Yes?
If the, at the time, the best technology and the purpose of the men on the, I forgot the word, the thing that fell down?
Lighthouse.
Has the technology improved where the bell can ring and the men could leave?
Oh, yes, absolutely. They're automated. Most
And that was not so then.
Oh, right, correct.
They had to stay there because they had to keep ringing the bell.
Exactly.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Well, they were heroes.
They were heroes. They were heroes, and they were men that, and they knew that their doom was imminent. In fact, I've read one account where the snow account has them fishing down the line into the water and trying to swim for their lives. Another account has them strapping themselves to the bell itself and getting over, having the lighthouse toppled, and Wilson freeing himself and swimming over to Gull's Rock there. So it's a tragic story. It was buffoonery in architecture by that Swift character. It's a dangerous area for a lighthouse. There's no lighthouses that are out at sea like that. Boston Harbor Light even has its own ledge. And it's, as they say, one day, maybe it's going to be toppled again. There's been fabulous pictures taken over the years of the waves breaking over this. Now, some contemporary bad storms. Do you remember hearing about the perfect storm?
Yes.
1991.
Yes.
I remember that.
93, I believe. 91. I'm so bad. After Hurricane 38, I don't know anything about weather. I'm a historian.
I was
yes.
on the elevator train going home from Boston.
During the Hurricane of 38? Well, does anybody else have any Hurricane of 38? While we're talking about that, I'd like to come back and talk about that storm in detail sometime. But
do you know how many lighthouses there are
in
this country?
At one time, there were 1,500.
Really?
Yes, yes. But now, operationally, I'd have to say there's less than 500. If I'd even argue
how
that there's...
How many in New England?
I don't have that figure. But it's obviously they're in coastal areas. A lighthouse in Nebraska doesn't get much business.
Remember the perfect storm.
Yeah, well, the thing is about the Hurricane of 38 is that we have not been hit with one, and people will get on. People have this sense that if they buy a gallon of milk, right, at the store, that they're going to be in a loaf of bread, they're safe against any storm. I mean, it's good to have that, but I try to tell people the most important thing to have in your possession
is a way to get out.
Oh, sure, but not only that, is drinkable water. As humans, we can last without food for up to 5 days. Water, you need that within 48 hours. So that's the thing, to get away from the shoreline. Now, here in Brookline, obviously, a hurricane, you're hunkered down, you're in a very concentrated area. You'd still, because you're on the coast, you'd be subject to high winds. And again, if a hurricane hit New England dead on, in most hurricanes, the 1635, the Great September Gale of 1815, and the Great Hurricane of 1938 have all come almost up the Cape Cod Canal. And that's where they move, and they go right up the Connecticut River Valley. So if you're to the east of the eye, you're going to get it. So One last thing is the Hurricane Service every year makes predictions of hurricanes, okay, mm-hmm. and everybody laughs at them because they've been so far off, and that's dangerous because then there'll be the boy that cried wolf, and when they say hurricane, the people won't react to it. And if New York City was hit the way the Hurricane 38 hit, it would be utter disaster, utter disaster.
I think they want to be overly cautious because people are more critical if they don't describe a storm accurate.
That's right.
Even if it's weaker than predicted.
That's right. And we're in an unprecedented period. And this concerns me. If I look at the historical weather record of New England over the past, say, 400 years, weather is controlled inadvertently by, as we know, the sun, but sunspots, I'm not going to give you some heavy astrophysics here, but sunspots are almost liver spots, they're magnetic solar storms, but the sun, it controls the amount of radiation being emitted from the sun, the particles of solar radiation that get to the earth. Anyways, we're in a very dormant period, and the last year and a half, there are no sunspots. And I want to tell you that the last time that the sun had no visible sunspots was in the early 19th century. And during that time, we had an unprecedented cold period called the Mini Ice Age, which was precipitated, among other things, by some volcanoes. And the volcano Tambora in the Philippines erupted in late 1815. 1816, the next year, was heretofore known as the Year Without a Summer, which in June 7th of 1816, it snowed on Boston Common. There was frost on the ground in August. Spectacular sunsets with the ash-laden atmosphere. And the growing seasons were off. And in fact, the following winter, I've been studying something known as these thunder snows. Electrical snowstorms with thunder and lightning. Very rare phenomena. We've all gone through them. But where these luminous snowstorms occurred, and I think it's because of the ash particles aloft, where vivid lightning storms and multiple lightning strikes during thunderstorms, during snowstorms, actually, of January of 1817. And of course, you know about 1816, the famous book Frankenstein was written because Percy Bysshe Shelley and his wife Mary, who couldn't write a thing, or so Percy thought, and a friend were in Lake Geneva in Switzerland. And it was such a bad, bad, rainy, cold, cold summer. They were all forced indoors, and they decided to have a writing contest. And, of course, Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein. And that's one of the good byproducts of the Year Without a Summer in 1816.
You used to take that Boston Harbor cruises during the summer, and Captain Snow, we used to have, he used to narrate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. Edward Rowe Snow, he did, yes. Captain Snow used to narrate. He was the folklorist. He was the best folklorist in the history of New England. And
How long does
it
get? I know.
1902 to 1982. Wow. 80 years old. Lived in Marshfield Hills. I had a chance to meet him when I was small. So. Yes?
Can you bring up a little bit more recently about the Great Molasses inundation?
The Great Molasses Flood took place on, I'm guessing now, January, I know the year, but the date, January 16th or 15th, 1919. And molasses was shipped into Boston Harbor North End. It was stored in these big towers, okay? And that day in January was an unseasonably warm day, and there was no ventilation, proper ventilation in these molasses tanks, and the heat is combustible. Right, and so I think somebody was smoking nearby, you know, just like in the Hindenburg. I think there was a guy sneaking a smoke in the bag, but it blew up, and this huge 10-foot wall of heavy, thick, syrupy molasses moved down the streets of the North End, taking horses in its wake. Men, people drowned. I'm not sure what the exact number is. A friend of mine, Stephen Puleo, wrote a book called Dark Tide. It's the definitive account of the Great Molasses Flood. Dark Tide, get it? You'll love every word of that. Another book I want to recommend is Boston on Fire by my friend Stephanie Shoro. A wonderful book. Pick both of those books up. Fabulous. But that Boston flood, that molasses flood, it was said up until the years 1950, just after the war, on hot days you could still smell molasses. Yeah, up until the 50s.
What was the factory there, the last factory?
It was, well, there was, I know there was a tower, and it had to be near a candy factory or a rum factory, right? So, but it was 1919. In fact, the scene of that, the Brinks job, what was that, sir?
They probably made sugar out of it.
Okay, sure.
Sugar.
Yep. Well, so it was stored there, and again, I'm sure the ventilation wasn't proper. And
don't the lighthouses today still prevent major ship disaster?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What about minus light?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, it's still, the Grampuses are still just as nasty as they were during Samuel Champlain's time. I mean, those rocks didn't go away. Those shoals are nasty, and they'll rip open your hull, and any mariner that comes on those rocks and is getting blown onto them is totally helpless. Mm-hmm. In fact, I mentioned about the brig, the St. John, at the opening of my talk. An Irish immigrant ship known as a famine ship, a coffin ship, because they pack you on like sardines. People trying to escape the Great Potato Famine during the 1840s from Ireland got on this brig called the St. John. They left in September of 1849, and they arrived just outside Boston of October 1849. And here they are sitting out at the coast of Cohasset. It was a very primitive lighthouse there. Actually, it was the beginning of the construction of it. It's 2 years into the construction. And they see this ship, British ship called the Kathleen foundering. So the captain puts his whole crew and passengers in peril by chasing after the Kathleen, which only had about six people on it, trying to save them. So the men put out the Coast Guard men, that they put out their longboats. They'd row out into the chopping surf. They go out and they see a boat coming in, and it just has a handful of survivors from the St. John, the captain, his crew, and a few other people. So he thinks all the people are off to St. John and heads towards the Kathleen. All the people had left the Kathleen and gotten to shore safely. Meanwhile, there's almost 85 people drowning out by the St. John. So it was an unfortunate, and they couldn't hear because the wind was blowing. So it was an unfortunate error by the longboat men, the life-saving station. And to this day in Cohasset Cemetery, there is a gravesite or a marker commemorating the wreck of the St. John. And there's some people claim that they have pedigree and descendants that came on that ship. But anyways, it's been a pleasure speaking with you this morning, and I hope that everybody, actually this afternoon, I hope everybody has a great day. Yes. You can visit it by boat, but you can't get off the boat and climb up the side of the lighthouse. That's the only way to get in now, is to climb up. You can't, by law, it's locked up, so...
So.
Well, thank you very much, everybody. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, John.